a hard choice between the employee who has violated the rules and endangered his peers on the job and the good employees who come to work every day clean and sober and do their jobs, who have to lose their jobs because the economy is so bad and they have to make those hard choices every day. And when you have to allocate those scarce resources, one of the considerations that those employers want to make is, if you are a good employee and you follow my rules, I want to give you the greater benefit, you know, my limited largesse. The additional point that relates to drug and alcohol concerns in the workplace is this one. The treatment community tells us, those of us who are employers and those of us who work with employers, that the best thing that you can do to get somebody clean is to practice a form of tough love that sounds like this: get well or get out. Because the way that the disease of addiction takes hold of individuals is that those around them take care of them. The wives and husbands call in and report off sick, and the treatment community calls that enabling. When you have further sources of income which permit employees to continue the self-destructive behavior, you aren't necessarily doing a favor. And what you really should be doing in the employment community is working with treatment to say, get clean, follow the rules. If you don't, there are going to be economic consequences to you, and they'll be dire. The way that the legislation is structured is the employee doesn't have to make an entire lifestyle change in 10 days, but at least has to take that first important step in entering treatment, which is a good compromise, at least in the structure of the bill. I'd like to now turn to, if I might, the changes, just to walk you through what is proposed in this legislation, and this is more of, I believe, in the form of an introduction. The primary change that the bill would make to the statute is to bring into the definition of disqualifying misconduct. So if you commit misconduct, you don't get unemployment benefits. To bring into the definition of misconduct very specific drug and alcohol-related misconduct that has come from either the current existing regulations from the Employment Department or additional areas where we believe the legislation needs to be ramped up and to address some additional issues. The first is that an employee who fails or refuses to take a drug or alcohol test as required by the employer's reasonable written policy. That is current regulation, and that would just be incorporated into the statute. The next addition would be it is misconduct and therefore will result in a denial of benefits if the employee refuses to cooperate with or subverts or attempts to subvert a drug or alcohol testing process that is required by that policy. And then there are a certain number of examples of how that might happen. Employers who have introduced testing policies, and most of them have done so to protect all of their workforce from the kind of harm that impaired workers can cause, find that over their experience, employees have become extraordinarily creative in beating drug tests. If you were to do an internet search, and I do these occasionally just to try to stay up on what's going on, you will find more than 1,000 websites which will teach employees how to beat a drug test. That includes refusing to complete proper documentation. The drug testing process is highly documented so that it is fair. Collection facilities have clear documentation, much of it modeled on federal Department of Transportation regulations that employees have to execute. But all an employee has to do is give a false name, a false ID, or sign the forms Donald Duck, and they can subvert the testing process because then you don't have a documented chain. So refusing to complete proper documentation would be part of misconduct, and that's current regulation as well. Refusal to verify the chain of custody, what that relates to is a refusal to sign or to properly sign a chain of custody form. That's mandatory in the drug testing process, and that simply means I'm going to try to subvert it. Presentation of false identification, I believe, is current policy, and that would be a disqualifying act. Possession of known adulterants would be a disqualifying act, and that would be possession when the employee shows up to give the specimen. Again, there are hundreds of websites which for $29.99 will sell you something that is guaranteed to clean out your urine so that you can pass a drug test. Wonderful inventive names like You're in the Clear. Laboratories can identify in testing known adulterants, and there is a very comprehensive federal testing protocol which has been developed under a massive Department of Transportation drug testing program which tells labs how they are to do that. Interfering with the accuracy of test results by conduct that includes dilution or adulteration. Dilution is another very popular way of interfering with a test. This is current regulation, which would be moved into the statute. The statute would also disqualify from benefits misconduct which would take the nature of being on the job under the influence of intoxicants. Now, that's a standard that is current policy. It is, frankly, difficult for employers to work with, which is why, and I will get to this in a moment, there are objective tests as well. We understand what it means to be under the influence of alcohol because there are medical standards which tell us, and we have criminal laws which tell us, we have driving laws which tell us. It's a little bit more difficult with drugs because they are so varied and bodies react in such varied ways. But being under the influence is also current regulation, which would be moved into the statute. The next would be to possess a drug unlawfully or in violation of the employer's policies. Again, that's current policy. Individuals, employees should not be bringing illegal drugs into the workplace. Employees who have heavy-duty prescription medication should abide by their employer's reasonable policies for bringing that medication onto the workforce. The next area of disqualification would be testing positive for alcohol or unlawful drugs. If it is in the employee's body, experts will tell you that there is no known safe amount. Now, there is a subculture that believes that marijuana stays in the body for a very long time, and it can be detected for a very long time in very, very heavy users if you test down to the absolute maximum limit that a lab can test. Typically, a marijuana test under the workplace cutoffs will not be positive after a few days. So there is a lot of erroneous information floating around on that. The problem that employers face is if it is in the employee's body, there is no expert that can say 50 nanograms of marijuana is safe. You know, if that information doesn't exist.
Could I stop you for a minute, Paul?
Yes, please.
I just had a question. You're using drug in the bill, and I mm-hmm. see where you've changed controlled substance to drugs or mm-hmm. alcohol. Can you just mm-hmm. tell me why you've done that?
I think that was done for clarification because there is a federal controlled substances statute. There's a state controlled substances statute, and drug is going to be defined in this proposed legislation to refer back to the Oregon Controlled Substances Statute. So it's sort of a shorthand version of doing it. I don't believe that it makes a substantive change, except for it does further clarify.
Thank you.
So there is this difficulty that employers have to address, which is what's the known safe level? We don't know what the known safe level is, and historically, many employers have had significant accidents which have harmed a number of individuals, and even at fairly low levels. We don't know how people's bodies react to certain levels of drugs. The federal program, the massive Department of Transportation testing program, was actually started after the Amtrak Conrail crash that happened back east and injured, and my recollection is something like 270 citizens, individuals were hurt. Operators on that on the locomotive that caused the crash subsequently testified to Congress and talked about his own pattern of alcohol and drug use. Interestingly enough, in that the people who caused the accident actually passed a visual inspection by a supervisor. Supervisors are simply not trained and can't be trained effectively to say, you're impaired, you're not impaired. And if I were working with an employer, frankly, I would say, don't have your supervisors doing that. They have no way of knowing if somebody has a medical condition that makes them unfit to perform the job safely. Unfortunately, we don't have the kind of wonderful test that we can say, you know, go ahead and do three things on a computer and we'll clear you to see whether or not you're impaired on the job. The best tool that employers have right now is the fail a drug test, pass a drug test. The statute would also include language to disqualify from receipt of unemployment benefits somebody who refuses to enter into the terms of a last chance agreement. And Representative Shoffley, this is another area where many, many employers that I work with try very hard to help their employees out and work with the treatment community. They will say, we will give you leave, go into treatment. When you come back and you're ready to come back to work, we will put you into an open job. But you have to sign this document, and it's going to be a contract between you and me that says you are not going to fall off the wagon again, and the next time you do, you're gone. It's sort of a form of tough love that the treatment community tells us works well with employees, because the last thing that they want to lose is their job. So that's sometimes the only hook that you have to get them back into sobriety. Refusing to sign a last chance agreement is a disqualifying event. Similarly, the statute attempts to, or the proposed statute attempts to, pick up some creative defenses that we have heard over the years, one being that what I've called in shorthand form the devil made me do it defense. I'm an addict, I'm impaired, I use the drug because I'm impaired, therefore I shouldn't be disqualified from benefits. That isn't a defense in the criminal law. It shouldn't be a defense for receipt of benefits, particularly in these very, very tough economic times. There is a proposal to add in further disqualifications where an employee refuses to accept a position because they'll be subject to a drug or alcohol testing program. That is certainly, and I think we would all accept and agree, an individual's choice. If you don't want to go work for an employer that has a drug and alcohol testing program, absolutely don't go work for that employer. But the question is, should you then be entitled to be on the dole, as they say, for refusing to compromise your personal principles? And in days when we're all struggling very, very hard to take care of those folks who have lost their jobs in the economic times, that's simply an unfair choice to force employers or the state to make. The proposal finally defines a number of terms, and those would be technical for use in the statute. Drug, we've already talked about, is defined as a controlled substance under Oregon law. Last chance agreement is defined so that we all know what that kind of last chance agreement is. It permits a return to work on condition that the employee continue to abstain. The proposal does not mandate, the last chance agreement as defined doesn't require an individual to take treatment as you would define medical treatment. It also includes as an option education, and this is something that I always recommend to employers, and the explanation goes something like this. You have an employee who tests positive for marijuana, some sort of drug that perhaps can be used casually without addictive effects. So you have an employee who has made a lifestyle choice but may not be sick. It would be unfair to that individual to say, go through a treatment program, and frankly, it would take up a bed in a treatment program that somebody needs more. But maybe what this individual needs is education. So as an option, many employers say, if you don't need treatment and your doctor says you don't need treatment, that's fine, you don't have to go to treatment, but I'm going to mandate a drug education program. It would be very similar to the kind of diversion programs that we use under criminal law. And then finally, the statute would propose to define under the influence of intoxicants, which would include both alcohol and drugs, and at least give a workable, objective statutory definition to that term which appears in the statute. That's my walk through the statute. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Well, thank you, Paula. That is very informative. I think we all learned a great deal. And we have questions from a number of members, Representative Gallego and then Merkley.
Thank you. As I'm reading this, something caught my eye, and that is that an individual may not be disqualified from receiving benefits, and that's if the individual is a victim of domestic violence. Maybe the unemployment office would help me understand but what if the person has also failed a drug test? And is those sometimes, and there seems to be several combinations of other things that a person cannot be dismissed for, yet may still have failed a drug test or have other issues with relating to drug and alcohol, and how those would.
My understanding, Madam Chair, members of the committee, is that the domestic violence portion, and I believe the Employment Department can supplement this as well, many, and unfortunately it's usually women who are victims of domestic violence, they often need to leave the workforce for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it's the trauma of their lives. Sometimes it's because if their abusive spouse knows where they work, they are very much at risk. And the concern has always been, is it good cause to leave a paying job if you do so under those circumstances and there was a policy choice made to protect those people who were forced to leave the paying workforce because of situations involving domestic violence. One issue that would certainly come up if that employee were also terminated for a drug and alcohol issue. And at least the way that I believe the law would apply, but certainly you would go through a factual hearing, is if the actual reason for the loss of the job was the domestic violence or a quit because of that, that would not be disqualifying. But if the actual reason or the substantially motivating reason for the loss of the job would be a drug or alcohol offense in the workforce, that would be disqualifying. So the purpose of the administrative hearing before the Employment Department referee would be to isolate what was the reason for the loss of the job.
Thank you. Representative Merkley.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm intrigued by the structure of the bill, mm-hmm. because most of what we're amending in subsection 9 says it's for the purposes of subsection 2. Subsection 2 is all about the disqualification of benefits, and then starts with a list of disqualifying factors that refers to if the authorized representative, this is line 17 on the first page, mm-hmm. if the authorized representative designated by the director finds that the individual, and then A, B, C, D, E, F, G, so on and so forth. This authorized representative is someone designated by the Director of Employment Department. That framework, then, which says these are the disqualifying factors as yes. determined by the authorized representative, is then Section 9 is interesting in that it then continues a list of disqualifying factors that would seem logically to fit right under that structure in subsection 2, but makes no reference to the authorized representative or no finding that the individual has, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Is this simply a drafting quirk, or is this related to a different perspective? You want one list in which an authorized representative is involved and one list in which they're not?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I can't speak to what went into the drafting itself, except to this extent. The authorized representative would still be the first line of administrative decision making, and that would be somebody who would come before a hearing level. And I have always read this personally from a legal perspective as the new issues on Section 9 being further explication of what misconduct connected with the work is. They seem to be put together, and certainly if I were designing the statute, it is something that I would attempt to do because they all relate to the same subject, so that if you're trying to zero in on how to deal with the issue, you at least have a statute that groups all of those concepts together. That doesn't mean that if there were to be later drafts that it couldn't conveniently be moved into Section 2. But many of the Oregon statutes that relate to employment and have drug and alcohol issues have the drug and alcohol issues as a separate statutory section so that a practitioner or somebody interested in that can zero in on, yes, I know the general framework, now how do I deal with the drug and alcohol issues? I don't think that it would make significant differences in how the statute would operate if it were to be moved into Section 2 or right next to Section 2.
Follow that up, Madam Chair.
Representative Merkley, please make it brief. We have a long list.
It sounds like you're saying then that even though it's structured separately with a different introduction, these findings would still be findings made by the authorized representative.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. I had a couple of questions. One, I wanted, and I guess it could be any of the witnesses, for you to clarify something that was said in response to Representative Schaffler about people being given the opportunity to go to treatment mm-hmm. and they wouldn't be disqualified from benefits. My reading of that statute is that only applies if you are terminated for tardiness or absence from work due to drug or alcohol use, so that has nothing to do with the new disqualifications that are set out in this bill. There's no requirement that I can see in what you've added or what is in law right now that people be given an opportunity to go to treatment if they're fired for failing a test. Is there something I'm missing here?
You know what?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I guess I'm not following your question. The if
well, just to clarify, mm-hmm. I'm looking at the mm-hmm. section on page one of the bill mm-hmm. that does talk about somebody participating in the drug rehab program or being given the opportunity to do so within 10 days. But my reading of that says discharged or suspended for being absent or tardy in reporting to work, and the absence or tardiness occurred as a result of the unlawful use of,
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I will double check, but it's my understanding that it's got the or, so they've been discharged or those other things have happened and they go into the treatment program within 10 days. It's my understanding this language would still apply even if the newly enacted proposed language was adopted. If the employer had those elements but the worker went into a treatment program within 10 days, that section would still apply. But I'll double check that.
But I guess maybe I'm not making my mm-hmm. question clear. My question is, if somebody is fired for the circumstances laid out that are new in this bill, and that is failure to take a mm-hmm. test, supply the proper documentation, or testing positive, if that's the reason the person is fired, my reading is they're absolutely disqualified from benefits. And these other categories of termination, which are for tardiness or absence from work, those circumstances don't apply to the terminations we're now talking about.
Chair Close, members of the committee, in my reading of the statutory language here, what they're talking about is that they were in line end of line 28, end of line 27, that the person was tardy. It appears that it's saying unless the person was participating in a recognized drug rehab program at the time of the absence or tardiness, and then there's a comma, and then it says, or is so participating within 10 days of the date of the discharge or suspension. That's all part of paragraph 2, and if you look at A, B, C, D, E, F, so forth, those are the discharges and suspensions that I believe that they're talking about. So my reading of this would be that if you were late, tardy because you were in a drug rehab program, that would not be a disqualifying event. Or if you're participating within 10 days of the date of discharge in rehab, would be not a disqualifying event.
Quick follow-up, and then we need to move on.
So is it your testimony that in addition to what's already in the law, that people will be given a chance to go into treatment if they fail a drug or alcohol test? Or that if they're not given a chance, they will still get unemployment benefits? Or that they will get unemployment? I mean, my reading of this bill is a positive test result is an automatic disqualification from benefits. And so I'm just asking you to tell me my misinterpreting the bill.
And I think that's correct, unless they go into rehab within 10 days.
I don't see that in the bill. I only see that if they're fired for tardiness or absence from work. So maybe it needs to be amended.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the other thing, just in closing, wanted to advise that the Employment Department had some concerns that they've raised that we're going to be working with them to discuss, and there'll probably be some amendments introduced for this bill, but we do appreciate the time you've taken to listen to our concern.
Thank you very much. Thank you, panel. Appreciate it. Committee, there are six more people to testify on this bill, and I'm going to close this hearing for the time being for about 10 minutes so that we can do some of the work on our agenda that we need to get done today while we have a quorum. So we will intend to come back in about 15 minutes. I'm closing the hearing on House Bill 2824. I'm going to open a public hearing on, a work session on House Bill 2313. And have the staff give us the situation on this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2313, we passed out of committee on the 10th and went to the consent calendar. It was a technical correction to the statutes relating to vehicle dealer franchises. It was our understanding that the bill didn't do anything substantive, and there's been some concerns expressed that it may have some interpretations that it does do some things that are not intending to do, so we'd like to bring it back to committee, and in order to do that, we need to make some motions to suspend the rules today and vote to bring it back.
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2313.
Representative Gallegos moves the rules be suspended for the purposes of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2313. Are there objections? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2313 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gallegos moves that we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2313 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendations. Are there objections? So ordered. Okay, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2313. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2682 and have the staff bring us up to date on that bill. You have two sets of amendments, committee, on this bill. The dash twos are being passed out as we speak, and this had to do with the loan originators and the criminal background checks. And I will call forward while we're getting that done. John McCauley.
Yeah, there's a dash three in here. It should be dash two.
I have it. Dash okay. Three and dash
two. Dash three is where the loan originator. Dash two. John McCauley is just calling, and I have no idea.
Okay, John, you're on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is John McCauley, representing the Oregon Association of Mortgage Brokers. I apologize to you for the lateness in getting these amendments to you. We had a miscommunication in Legislative Council. They were under the impression they were due at 5 o'clock today instead of 5 o'clock last night, so that's why you had them rushed to you this morning. So I appreciate your courtesy in holding on to this bill until those amendments could be developed and copied for you. I'm going to speak to the dash 2 amendments. At the public hearing that we had a few days ago, Representative Merkley asked a question about page 1 in the bill, lines 24 and 25, that gives the director of DCBS authority to adopt rules on how the criminal background checks could be conducted. And Representative Merkley wanted to know if that would then allow the director to include in those rules prohibitions or crimes that could be included in prohibiting people to work. And I hastily answered the question, yes, I thought it could, but upon further evaluation, I think we do need an amendment to give the director rulemaking authority to determine the categories of crimes that might be included here and sanctions that could be levied for people who have violated or committed those crimes. So the dash 2 amendments, lines 3 through 7, would replace lines 24 through 25 in the printed bill. And primarily, lines 6 and 7 of the dash 2 amendments would give the director authority to adopt rules specifying the categories of criminal convictions that will prevent a person from acting as a loan originator under ORS 59971. And then the amendments also add language in ORS 59971 that detail the prohibition of work if a person has committed one of those crimes. And those are the primary changes to the bill proposed in our dash 2 amendments. I do note that Legislative Council has made a technical amendment on line 8 of the dash 2 amendments. There was an incorrect reference in the current statute, and they are correcting that reference. So those are the amendments, Madam Chair.
And John, have you looked that up to see what reference they're correcting? Or?
Well, they are actually correcting 59971, if you'll look on the bottom of the amendments here. They referenced a subsection 4 in 59.971. There is no subsection 4 in those amendments or in that statute, so they corrected that reference.
Good idea. Okay, questions for John?
I would also add, Madam Chair, we do support the other amendments that are proposed to the bill by Mr. Powell in the insurance industry.
Okay. Thank you so much. And we'll have Mr. Powell come forward. These are the dash threes, I believe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Company. Before you, the dash three amendments to the bill, and as you may recall from the hearing, we raised the question as in terms of the definition of who is a loan originator could pick up some insurance agents who facilitate an occasional loan. And so legislative counsel has drafted the dash three amendments to change the definition of loan originator to take care of that problem. And as you'll recall, I had mentioned a 60-day threshold for conducting other types of business. So if you look at the amendments, the change occurs on line six of the bill by putting a colon after the word who. So a loan originator means an individual who, and then on line three of your amendments, who is an insurance agent or consultant licensed under 744-002, has not transacted insurance as defined in the insurance code for a period of 60 consecutive days, and would qualify as a full-time loan originator if not exempt under this statute. So in essence, it means if a person is not writing other insurance business and all they're doing is originating loans, then they are a loan originator and would be picked up under the provisions of this bill.
Questions for John? Okay, I think that's really clear.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Kitts, we are in work session.
I would, you may move.
That's still both amendments.
Both amendments?
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, I would move that we accept both the dash 2 and dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2682 as amended.
Representative Kitts moves the dash 3 and the dash 2 amendment into House Bill 2682. Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I would move that we move House Bill 2682 to the floor with a declass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2682 as amended to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Gallego?
Aye.
Representative
Berard?
Representative
Merkley?
Aye.
Representative
Schaffler?
Aye.
Representative
Kitts?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair Close. Full time. Motion carries. And our carrier will be... Who has an interest in this bill?
I'll do it.
Representative Kitts will be the carrier. And I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2682. Okay, so we're back to the public hearing, correct? Okay. I hope we haven't lost too many people. I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2824 and call forward J.L. Wilson and Daryl Fuller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing NFIB Oregon. We represent 12,000 employers in the state of Oregon. The particulars of the bill have been discussed thoroughly and well, so I think I'm going to stick to the broad overarching business themes associated with House Bill 2824. A couple of premises that underlie our support for this bill. The first is that unemployment compensation is legally restricted to people who are unemployed through no fault of their own. But to the extent that current law allows benefits for people who choose to violate workplace drug and alcohol policies and are subsequently terminated, we do believe that that is a violation of the integrity of Oregon's unemployment insurance program. Second, our position is that an employer's written drug and alcohol policy is and should be considered reasonable in and of itself. Now, just to clarify what you're talking about, when you're talking about written policies with regard to drug and alcohol, what I work under, for example, is a policy that says any illegal manufacture, distribution, dispensing, possession, or use of illegal drugs, or unauthorized possession or use of alcoholic beverages on premises or during work hours are grounds for immediate discharge. An employee reporting to work under the influence of drugs and alcohol can be subject to administrative leave without pay, referral for testing, discharge, and or other action deemed appropriate. Goes down to say that NFIB reserves the right to perform random drug testing or require physician certification of an employee's drug-free status. That certification will be required at the discretion of NFIB management and is required as a condition of continued employment. Refusal to submit or a positive result of a test could result in discipline up to and including termination. That is what you likely see in a workplace drug and alcohol policy, and we believe that those things are reasonable in and of themselves. And we believe that there it's probably not best for those things to be subject to a third-party determination of what constitutes reasonable, in this case, the employment department. And so I think that those are a couple of things that you need to consider. The overarching theme for us is really this. Government is in a position to either help or undermine an employer's ability to keep a safe workplace. And this is an instance where you'll be seen as either lending assistance and lending teeth to the law, or whether you're going to undermine these efforts. I don't think that there's any doubt that anybody in this room expects employers to maintain safe workplaces for their employees. And in all instances, it means an alcohol-free and drug-free workplace. So the question is, are we going to put teeth in those policies that reinforce an employer's workplace policy, or are we going to have or allow instances in which those policies can be undermined, and in fact you can even penalize an employer because their experience rating is affected when you charge UI benefits to their account? So I think there's a real black and white choice here. You know, obviously there may need to be some technical fixes to the bill to allow for some language changes, for clarification, but I don't think there should be any doubt that there should not be loopholes, there should not be fuzziness that could potentially allow for undermining of workplace policies set by the employer. So the extent that House Bill 2824 clarifies these statutes, sets them in stone, makes them black and white, we are very supportive of House Bill 2824. Thank you.
Representative Merkley and then Kitts.
Thank you very much, JL. JL, we had, I believe her name was Paula, who was testifying. And I asked her about the separation between subsection 2 and subsection 9 and as to whether that subsection separation had anything to do with the third-party role of the authorized representative. And she indicated, at least I understood her indicate, that no, this was just as if these were written in subsection 2. But then I just heard you say that these provisions are not something that you feel should be subject to a third-party determination. Do you see these as separate in this list under subsection 9, separate and distinct from the role of those items under subsection 2?
Thank you. Chair Close and Representative Murray, I do not. I want to make very clear. I believe that these lend some black and white qualities to what subsection 2 entails or puts into place. But it's not something that I see outside of the scope of what a third party would look at and decide what's a disqualifying act.
Thank you.
And you did not want to ask a question. Okay, Daryl.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Daryl Fuller. I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association, which, if you look on the information distributed by Associated Oregon Industries, I'm one of the organizations supporting the bill. But I'm actually here today because this session I have the privilege of serving as the president of the Oregon Small Business Coalition. And in the interest of time, I want to just let you know that the Oregon Small Business Coalition has voted to endorse the bill, and I like everything that JL said.
Okay. Thank you for your briefness. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thanks, Madam Chair. JL or Daryl, either one of you, I am concerned about imposing some requirements on small business that we may not have, and these may be in the rules, and I'm just not familiar with them, but do generally all small employers have written policies in place now that deal with drug and alcohol use and testing and specify all these things that are laid out? I'm just concerned that there may be an employer out there that has a reasonable policy but hasn't filed it as a legal written document and might be caught up in a new requirement.
Thank you. Chair Close and Representative Rosenbaum, there's no question that there are obviously small employers out there who do not have written policies. And it's likely because you'll find that the level of sophistication among small employers is low sometimes. And I can speak for our family radio stations, you know, being in operation for 45 years, it's only been in the last 10 years that we had a consultant come in and say, these are the things that you need to do to protect yourselves. And we've had a drug and alcohol workplace policy in effect since about 1992, which is to say we were in business for 35 years without one. But I also think that we're emblematic of a trend, and that is, I think you're a much greater volume of employers recognize the need for these types of things. And so do I think it's expanding and expanding rapidly? Yes. Do all employers, small employers, have them? No, not at all.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. We're going to move on. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to call forward Patrick Green, AFL-CIO. Dave? I'm sorry, Dave. Your name?
Fidanki.
Thank you. And Ed Glad with the Carpenters. Good morning.
Good morning.
And if you guys can keep your testimony around 3 minutes each, then we'll have time for questions. I want to be sure that you have time for people to ask you questions.
Okay, great. We'll make it quick. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Patrick Green. And I represent the Oregon AFL-CIO. We think that we're opposed to House Bill 2824. We think that the bill is unnecessary at this point, and that this is an area of the law that's already settled. I think that in the walk through the bill, there was a number of sections, a large amount of the sections that are the current operational working rules that are already done. And we believe they're already adequate to ensure that workers who impair their work performance due to drug and alcohol use and who lose their jobs as a result are not allowed to collect UI benefits currently. We think that the bill crosses a line between on-the-job obligations and off-the-job behavior. Section 10 of the bill, we think, is the most objectionable because it extends disqualification for UI benefits for workers who have already qualified for and are properly receiving those benefits to events that are subjective. For example, failing to apply for certain jobs or avoiding an alcohol or drug test seem to be fairly subjective and could be in the eye of the beholder, especially when we have a problem in terms of who is adjudicating this, and have nothing to do with one's prior separation from work or qualification for unemployment. And Section 9, we also have a problem with, because one of the things, and it was skipped over during the proponent's testimony in Section 9 sub D, is one of the reasons for disqualification could be under the influence of intoxicants during work or while on the employer's premises. And we wonder how that would affect a bartender or server who is in their establishment, place of employment as a customer, or even in a larger setting, someone who goes to a ball game, they work there, they're not working, and they become intoxicated. That would be on their employer's premises, but according to this, could result in them being disqualified for unemployment. So I know we're in a hurry, so I'll leave it at that and let the other folks testify. Thank you for your time.
I don't know if you took your whole 3 minutes.
Okay.
Can I use a 30 of a second?
Yes. Representative Shoffler.
You know, I want to know how anybody, and I'm not taking this subject matter lightly, and I don't want anyone to think I am, because I'm not, but how does one avoid, let me see, where is it? How does one avoid being discharged from this kind of, you go hide or something? How do you avoid being discharged? That does seem to be strange language. How do you avoid being fired?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, I don't know the answer to that. I do know one of the problems with this bill is the regulation of off-the-job behavior, including the example I gave of the bartender who is not on the job who becomes intoxicated. That would be intoxication in their workplace, but also tests during pre-employment and pre-placement, which would lead me to believe that somebody then could be disqualified when they're disqualified from unemployment benefits from their previous employer when they're seeking employment, which would be, I guess, DWUI as opposed to DWI. That's a joke. anyway, the pre-employment, the off-the-job regulation of off-the-job behavior we find as a problem as well. Thank you.
And I can't speak for the drafters, but I would guess that would not be their intent to deny former benefits. That you're right. It needs to be clarification. Were there more questions for Patrick? Okay, go ahead.
For the record, my name is Ed Glad. I represent the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. On the sign-in sheet, I put against the bill, probably because my sister is a libertarian and would strangle me if I said that I was for the bill. We're in conflict on this bill, and there's a couple of reasons. The carpenters, our dues money goes for, the dominance of our dues money goes for training, both apprenticeship training and journeyman upgrade training. The other preponderance of our dues money goes for organizing, and this issue actually converges both of those activities that we spend our dues money on, training and organizing. Because it's very important in our industry to have well-qualified people to be able to stand underneath that crane that is loading material into a specific spot and then move that material into what has to become eventually a building. It's very, very important us to be working safe and to be working around people safely. What's been very evident, though, in our organizing campaigns, in knocking on the doors of many people who practice the craft of carpentry, is that the reason that they do not want to belong to our organization, despite the fact that of the availability of advancing their craft skills, is that they don't want to work on jobs where there's drug testing. The predominance of people who are staking out that position, who are practicing the craft of carpentry, are not necessarily drug users, but are exercising what they believe is their American freedom not to have to be tested for something that they do in their spare time. So here we are in the 21st century, obviously in the late 20th century as well, up against a societal problem that has plagued us in a way that we don't know, or we keep stabbing in the dark, essentially to find answers to the problem. This is essentially, in our eyes, driving people out of the construction industry in order to be free. They're in a different part of the construction industry. But those of us that live and work in these buildings that, you know, really require a skilled workforce to be able to put together are finding that the workforce is diminishing over and over again because one of the major problems is drug testing. So essentially, my libertarian sister is echoing in my words is that, or in my head here, is that there's something wrong with us being willing to stratify society, that the working people themselves are being tested for drug abuse, but the people who run the companies, the independent contractors and the contractors, are allowed to work, are allowed to contract out there and not be subject to the same standards, and that there's a problem in our eyes with that. Thank you.
Well, Ed, I will tell you that my husband is in marketing for a major company in Portland, and last week he had to leave his office and go get the drug test. So I know that some companies do it with their their administrative.
Sure. I appreciate, Chair Close, I appreciate your comment. And that's part of the dilemma that we're in, is that the major companies and the reputable companies that do good work and are trying to address this are spending their resources trying to address drug problems. What we're seeing, though, as carpenters, is that our skilled craftsmen are refusing to subject themselves, so that they're fleeing the reputable companies. They're actually moving away from the good bona fide companies that are willing to do the work in order to be able to avoid those drug tests. And this in itself, I think, I mean, if carpenters are leaving because they don't want to be drug tested, unemployment, they're choosing not even to receive unemployment because they're going to be independent contractors. They don't even pay into the unemployment insurance program. So,
can I ask you, in construction, are there companies that don't drug test? I
mean, absolutely.
There are.
Absolutely.
So they have options.
On the union side of the industry, I mean, if you could just simply break down the industry into union and non-union, on the union side of the industry, there's very few, if any, I don't know of any who do not drug test or who do not expect a drug test. We have great companies like Hoffman Construction. A number of my most respected friends actually are reformed drug and alcohol abusers because they worked with me at Hoffman Construction, you know. Hoffman Construction has a unique program to their system. Baugh Construction has the same thing. A number of the large companies have their own drug testing programs. And then we have a workforce drug-free program that, you know, all sorts of smaller outfits can actually pay into that and have, you know, the union members that are working on their jobs be drug tested. What we're talking about, though, is that once you leave that union side, it is all over the board. There are certainly reputable contractors who are so-called merit shop that do drug testing. But once you get on that side, there's no way to actually monitor, and it filters right on down to many, many people. And you all have heard at least one. You're going to hear another of the independent contractor loosening the definition of independent contractors. That gives opportunity for more people to flee the organized labor side that is providing that training to have a skilled workforce to move into being independent contractors. That then puts them in a place where they can avoid these issues altogether.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, David Fidanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. And I should start out by letting you know I am not an attorney. I have worked for the ACLU since 1982 and have, I think, some familiarity with constitutional law, especially Oregon constitutional law. But more to the point, I testify in opposition to House Bill 2824 this morning because in the first instance, we believe this bill is unnecessary and may cause more problems than it solves. And let me just give you a couple of examples, and I'll try to keep this short. We heard from the opening witnesses in support of this bill that, at least I got the impression that it was their intent that if this bill is approved, that a positive result to any urine test would be taken as evidence of being under the influence of drugs on the job. And that's just wrong, because urine tests do not test impairment. They test for the metabolites, that is, the leftover indications that a person has had a particular substance in their system. They are not useful in determining whether someone is under the influence on the job. Current Employment Department regulations already have a definition of being under the influence of a drug on the job. I don't see how this legislation would improve upon those existing regulations. I do see that it could cause a lot of mischief in terms of reopening issues that are currently well settled. I also wanted to talk about the issue of disqualifying someone from receipt of unemployment benefits because they have refused to apply for a test for a job that was to which they were referred by the Employment Department, where there is a requirement to take a drug test. There may be very good reasons that the person is refusing to apply for that job. They may be under a doctor's care for a substance that would show up on a drug test. They may not want that medical condition that is related to their taking of that prescription drug to be disclosed. If they qualified for unemployment compensation, then you are requiring as... Let me back up a sec. The person has qualified for unemployment insurance because they were qualified. They were not discharged from misconduct. They may have been laid off from their previous job. And you are now, as the state of Oregon, requiring a person to submit to a search of their body as a condition of continuing to receive unemployment benefits. Now that brings into play the Oregon Search and Seizure Clause, which prohibits the government from requiring an individual to submit to a search. And every court that's looked at urine testing has concluded that it is a search in the constitutional sense. Up until now, that has not been a requirement of Oregon law. If you make it a requirement of Oregon law for someone to submit to a search without suspicion that they've done anything wrong, you are bringing into play the Constitution. The Constitution does not protect individuals against actions by private employers, but it does protect individuals against searches by the government without probable cause and without a warrant. Madam Chair, I'll just leave it right there.
Okay, questions for our panel. Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, is it, regardless of, if you're laid off your job and you apply for employment benefits, one of the requirements of that, I believe, is to apply for other suitable work.
Suitable work. The problem with this bill, Representative Gallegos, is that it sweeps in that word suitable is a judgment call given the specific facts of an individual's case. This takes it out of that realm and makes it per se an unsuitable action by the person who's receiving benefits to refuse to apply for a job to which they've been referred, even though that job may be unsuitable for them.
I'll just say, even though you're not an attorney, you talk like one. So
I apologize.
I guess my question is, are you objecting to the unemployment policy outside the bounds of anything to do with drug and alcohol abuse on the job? Just, or are you saying that they've changed the context of that page 1, line 22?
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, as I read the bill and as I heard the earlier testimony in support of the bill, the whole purpose of this legislation is to take some of these issues out of away from the issue of reasonableness and suitability or unsuitability and make certain actions per se unreasonable and actions unsuitable that would automatically disqualify someone from receipt of unemployment benefits even though the job may not have been suitable for them.
Representative Rosemont.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Fedenke, I appreciate your comments about the connection or lack of connection between testing positive under this bill and actual impairment or something that would be related to the job. I wanted to ask you, though, also that there are provisions in here that allow people to be disqualified from benefits for diluting a specimen, which testimony has been could be drinking a lot of water before taking the test. Do you see anything in this bill that would allow people to make a case for there having been a false positive test or, you know, that they had other reasons why they drank a lot of water because they've been instructed to for health reasons? Or
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I have to admit I hadn't thought about that issue, and I would need to think about it in more detail. maybe I'll use that as an opportunity to talk about a whole other issue that I didn't address in my opening testimony, which is the issue of legal drug use in Oregon. Oregon voters approved the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act several years ago. If someone is registered with the health division and has a registration card for use of medical marijuana, that is not illegal drug use. And yet this bill would seem to disqualify anyone who used marijuana for any purpose, although the bill defines drug as defined in ORS Chapter 475. In some of the provisions relating to drug testing, do not refer back to illegal drug use. So there may be a situation where an individual tests positive as a result of a drug test, is not impaired on the job, is not violating Oregon drug law, but who would be disqualified from unemployment benefits as a result of this legislation. Current law does not require that result. This bill might, and it's another reason why we oppose the bill.
Thank you, gentlemen. We are out of time, so I appreciate it very much. Appreciate your briefness. I'm going to call Bill Cluding and Tom Byerly of the Employment Department. And we have about 5 minutes, gentlemen. We need
Chair Close. Bill Cluding had to go to another hearing, so he won't be here to testify.
Okay.
Told me on the way out the door.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Tom.
I think I can be quick.
Well, you've got 5 minutes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Byerly. I'm the Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance with the Employment Department. I'll be as brief as possible. The Employment Department is not taking a position on this particular bill. For the most part, in many areas, the bill codifies what we currently have in our administrative rules. Our only need is to be sure of the intent of the new language so we can try to apply it and be as consistent as we need to be. there are some sections in particular that... excuse me, I apologize. Some sections in particular that we would request some clarification on, and it begins on page 3 in subsection 9. In 9, little a, big C, 2, Ms. Barron earlier talked about the refusal or failure to verify the chain of custody. We would like some more clarification on that. She did say that it was the failure to sign the chain of custody form, but that really doesn't say that in this sentence. And it's been our experience that once you've signed that form, that sample is no longer in your custody if you're being tested. So it would seem like it'd be a bit onerous on the claimant to have to be testifying to that chain of custody. So we'd like a little bit more clarification on that. Further down in number 4 there, possession of a known adulterant, we'd kind of like some clarification on that as well. Sometimes people could be in possession of an adulterant that they don't know is an adulterant. They could be having some health food supplements or whatever that, while they don't know that, are technically an adulterant. So we'd like to have that clarified a little bit.
May I ask one quick question?
Sure.
Would not a gallon of water be, could not that be considered an adulterant?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, I would guess that would be. That's why we'd ask for the clarification.
And I don't know how many times I took frozen gallon jugs of water to work with me in the heat of the day.
How would you write that, Tom? Can you just give us an idea of how that would look? What do your administrative rules say, I guess?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm sorry. Just a second here. You know, when you're under pressure, you can never find it.
That's okay. Take your time.
Okay. know, I don't think we do have a rule that talks about the adulterants right now. And how I would write that, I'd have to frankly think about it for a while. I'm sorry.
Could you, I guess what I was wondering is if you could specify an amount of water that would not be an adulterant?
If water is an adulterant, I would think maybe a cup of water would be... Madam Chair, I can't respond to that. I don't know how we would get around that.
All right. Well, I'm assuming you'll be working with the drafters on this.
Absolutely. We plan to do that.
All right. Continue.
Okay, thank you. Further down in subsection 9 would be big F. We're not quite sure. We would need some more clarification on connection with employment because of the terms later in that sentence of pre-employment or pre-placement, because that's not really employment-related. I don't think that's fatal. I think we would just need to differentiate or describe more what that means. Furthermore, when we talk about pre-employment or pre-placement tests, this could be a potential administrative problem for us, because some people that may go out for a pre-employment test and then do fail or choose not to take the pre-employment test, we aren't necessarily going to know about it. And so we would need some sort of reporting mechanism, if this were in statute, to let us know of these incidences so we could follow up on them. So we would need some help with that area. One final comment on the next page in subsection 10, little d, to avoid being discharged from misconduct, we would like to get with the drafters and determine what the intent of avoiding or this language and how we could maybe understand what avoiding being discharged would really look like. That's all the comments I have. I'd be happy to answer questions if I could.
Questions for Tom. Representative Rosenbaum and then Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I realize we're short of time, and I hope we may be able to have the employment department back.
We will continue on this bill.
But I did want to ask you about your last comment about the new changes that are on page 4 that are disqualifications for refusing certain kinds of offers of work, because my reading of the language that you just spoke about, to avoid being discharged for misconduct of any kind, doesn't apply only to these drug or alcohol cases at all. It applies to every circumstance in which somebody qualifies for unemployment and then there's an allegation that they quit their job to avoid being discharged. And I would think that could be, you know, that you couldn't possibly meet some new demand on the job or a scheduling problem, child care, whatever, meant that you couldn't continue to work a spring shift or whatever, and you left the job voluntarily, but because of circumstances beyond your control. Is it your interpretation of that language that it would apply to a whole broad other category of circumstances other than just drug and alcohol cases?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, that was the conclusion I reached, and I don't know if that's the intent, and that's why I would ask for some clarification, because when I see the term misconduct of any kind, that takes me out of the drug and alcohol world a little bit, and so we'd have to determine the context of that.
Representative Merkley, last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are four different approaches to drugs in this bill as drafted now. We have drugs, we have unlawful drugs, we have unlawful use of a drug, and we have unlawful use of a drug clarified to not include a drug taken under the supervision of a licensed healthcare professional. To me, this is a fairly confusing array of related but distinct concepts that have been used in different places. For example, and I'm wondering why under existing statute, and this is page 1, line 30, as used in this paragraph, unlawful use does not include use of a drug taken under the supervision of a licensed healthcare professional. This clarification must have been placed there due to a previous problem, and yet this clarification is not repeated elsewhere where the revised language talks about unlawful use. And I'm wondering, for example, under the medical marijuana case that was listed earlier, would medical marijuana be an unlawful drug? Or would it be an unlawful use of a drug, or would it be would it qualify under unlawful use of a drug, even if I had the supervision of a licensed healthcare professional?
I would say, and the way we've applied this is, the unlawful use does not include the medical marijuana taken under the supervision of a licensed healthcare professional. In other words, they've registered with the health department that they are qualified for the use of the marijuana. Furthermore, this subsection, little f there, only is referring to discharges that occur as a result of being discharged or suspended for being absent or tardy. Okay, that's a very narrow focus for this subsection. So it wouldn't apply to any other circumstance other than separations resulting from those listed in the first line there on line 25.
Thank you very much, Tom. We're going to move on, but we will have you back, and we will look forward to your progress on this bill.
Thank you.
We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2824. And, committee, we have about 10 minutes each on these next two bills. Can't get a great amount done, but we're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2934 and call forward John Chandler. And have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2934 prohibits a governmental unit from establishing a system development charge for parks and recreation that exceeds the current level of service within that jurisdiction and establishes criteria for governmental units that establish improvement fees and system development charges for parks and recreation.
Good morning. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. John Chandler, legislative advocate here on behalf of the Oregon Building Industry Association and House Bill 2934. Madam Chair, I'll defer to how you want to structure this. We have two bills up on roughly the same set of topics. I can do this one separately from the other, or we can combine them into one. I think I'm going to make the same general presentation.
Okay.
In the interest of time.
I will close that public hearing on 2934. I'll open a joint hearing on House Bill 2934 and 2983.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, John Chandler for the record, Oregon Building Industry Association. What these bills will do, committee, is allow the use of system development charges for drug testing on the job site. That's actually not what they. That's not what they do. Just want to make sure you're still paying attention. Yes. By way of background, before, and I'm not going to go into the details of these bills for reasons which I'll get to in a moment, unless the committee wants to have some questions. By way of background, with regard to system development charges, these are legislatively authorized, locally imposed charges on development to pay for certain types of infrastructure. There's oftentimes a perception that the development community, the building community, does not like system development charges, and that's right, but we don't like them in the sense that nobody likes paying their power bill. We need system development charges at the local level because that allows necessary infrastructure to be built. We grump about them. We occasionally go to court about them. We squawk at cities when we think they're too high. But we support the concept, and we understand why they're necessary, and we believe that they help us get what we need in order to do our jobs. And for the most part, the system that we have in the state works fairly well. It went into the law in 1989 as a result of a joint effort between the home builders primarily and local governments. It's been amended a few times over the years, not extensively. The bills in front of you are in keeping with our practice over the years of working cooperatively with local government. The amendments that have been brought forward, at least in my tenure, which extends back to the start, have been worked out bills. And we intend to do that again. What I wanted to report to you this morning is that we do have a work group formed with the cities, the counties, the special districts, City of Portland, other interested parties, to work through language on the bills. And essentially what we are trying to do, Madam Chair, members of the committee, is discuss the problem areas from our standpoint that was simply brought the bills forward. Obviously, we think there are some. And then the process will be with our working group of our local government colleagues. Can we agree that there is a problem? Sometimes in years past, we have not been able to. And if we can agree that there is a problem, can we agree on how to fix it? And what we would like to ask the committee's indulgence in is to recognize we have this work group going forward and allow us to come back with a set of amendments once we go through that process. I'm optimistic. We've had a number of conversations already in advance of this hearing. I think we can reach some closure on some of these issues and try to get the system working better. To the bills just specifically, and one bit of historical data, House Bill 2934 is a bill, exact bill that was passed in 1999 as Senate Bill 1061, for those of you with good record keeping. That bill passed the legislature with bipartisan support and was vetoed by the governor. There was a lot of that going on, you may remember. And so we brought the same bill back. It's our intention to work on the concept there. It dealt exclusively with parks system development charges. It's our intention to try to roll, if we can again agree that there's a problem, agree on a solution, roll that into the other bill as part of a set of amendments, so we would just be moving one vehicle dealing with the subject of system development charges. And if you would like, Madam Chair, I'll be glad to walk through the other bill as far as the problems we're trying to identify. It might be simpler to wait. If you don't mind, I'm happy to respond to that or do whatever you'd like to do. Once we get a little further in our conversation with local government.
Well, I think we just have one other person, so why don't you take about 10 minutes, and then we'll go to Richard Reed. Could you tell us first, John, the work group, and maybe you said this, who's involved in the work group?
The interests involved are the League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties, Special District Association, City of Portland, and it seems like I may be missing one, Clackamas County, excuse me.
Thank you.
There's a handful of us that fiddle with this issue, both at the local level and legislatively, and we get back together periodically to fiddle some more. It's a good group, and we've worked together for many years, and I think understand each other's interests, both from the payer standpoint and the recipient standpoint. And they're all sitting in the room making sure I don't say something untoward, but... I hope, and Reef has a pretty good arm, so he can reach me with a file if he has to.
There he is.
2934, the bill that was passed in 99, the issue here is, again, with regard to park system development charges, dealing with level of service. And I will be as brief as I can here. The issue from our standpoint is, if a local government, and by the way, this doesn't really apply to the other sorts of SDC infrastructure, water, transportation, sewer, storm sewer, sanitary sewer. It's mostly a parks issue. The issue is level of service. If you adopt a system development charge at assuming a level of service up here, but your current residents have a level of service down here, what the bill says in essence is you have to figure out some way to get the existing residents to the same level of service you're charging the new development for, because... as I say, with parks, it's fairly unique. If you were short tennis courts or soccer fields or whatever, and the existing residents have new ones built by new residents, then they may go use them, which means that, from our standpoint, the new residents don't get the benefit of the bargain in terms of what they're paying for. That doesn't really happen with water and sewer. If you put in a new sewer line, it's unlikely the existing residents are going to come use the facilities in the new house without invitation, anyway. which gets back to the drug testing issue, but that's a separate conversation. House Bill 2983 and the reason I wanted to, I'll be very, very brief here, partly to keep faith with what I've told my colleagues in local government, also because a lot of the language in this bill is attempting to highlight issues that we think need further discussion, but the language itself is probably overbroad. For example, on the first page, line 12, parks and recreation, excluding open space and natural areas, that is overbroad. We're working with the Special Districts Association in particular on some language that will get at the issue we're trying to address there, which is, and let me back up, Madam Chair, if I may. And I'm sitting there during the other hearing trying to figure out how to say this in a way that won't get me in further trouble, but what we have is a system that works very well for the most part, and I think it's important for you to understand that. In most cases at the local level, system development charges are proposed and adopted without a court challenge, without even a whole lot of grinding noise locally. The system works well if everybody plays nice. Where we run into problems, frankly, and what we're trying to address in this bill is some situations where we believe the playing nice did not occur. And by way of illustration of that, not to get into the substance of this bill, last session we brought it through a bill that had some corrections in it. Because all of us have worked together on this issue for so long, it's easy to get forest and treat. And there was some stuff in the law that we could have sworn was there that turned out upon closer inspection and clever lawyering wasn't there. And last session, you may recall, we closed a loophole because the issue here then was you had to do a capital improvement plan. We thought the system was. Capital improvement plan first, telling what you're going to build, what you need for new development, and then based on that plan, you figure out what the system development charge ought to be, which makes absolute perfect sense. Linear logic, we all knew that was in the statute. It turned out it wasn't in the statute. The way the statute actually read was you could do the system development charge first and then figure out how much money you had and go build stuff. They had it wrong ends forward. So we closed that loophole, and we found out about it by a local government that had seen it and ran a system development charge that we thought was illegal, turned out to be perfectly legal, just dumb. So which is not, never mind. I'll let you finish that. I'll let you finish that one on your own. In this bill, we have a number of other examples like that, where the language that all of us working on this over the years would have agreed, or the concepts we would agree are, should be there, aren't, or are worded in such a way that local governments, and again, I'm not attributing any particular malice here, can exploit a loophole in a way that was not the intent of the parties to it. Excuse me, loophole apparently is pejorative. I heard a hiss back there. We'll take example of bad draft. We'll take advantage of bad drafting. That may be more acceptable. I realize one person's loophole is another person's darn fine policy. But, in any event, the changes in this bill are trying to get at some of those issues. For example, and one last brief one, in the bill, current law, it says that local government should consider thus and such. We've changed that on the second page to take into account, but it's also probably the wrong type of language. What we're trying to get at there is a couple of examples where local governments have said, yeah, we considered that, and then went on and did what they're going to do in the first place. Well, that wasn't the intent. We want to try to get back to a better understanding. Frankly, members of the committee, Madam Chairman, what we may bring back to you is some policy language. Rather than try to engineer this in such a way that we get very specific and try to draft it at the legislative level, is simply to put in some, and I'm thinking out loud here, this may not turn out to work, but to bring back to you something that says the intent of this legislation is to do this and this and this. Because, again, we support SDCs as a way of building necessary infrastructure. The local governments need SDCs as a way of getting that money. We just simply want the system, both of us, all parties involved, want the system to work fairly, equitably, and hopefully without a whole lot of litigation. A very vague description of the bill. I hope it's adequate. I'll be glad to respond to questions if you have them, and we will certainly continue working and bring back amendments should we be able to reach agreement.
Madam Chair.
Okay, we have about 2 minutes
very
for questions.
Briefly, Mr. Chandler, wouldn't it be fair to say that there are those in our community that use, and I'm a proponent of system development charges as they exist, that use SDCs not with the intent they were put in place for, but to obstruct and to slow progress, development, building, business in Oregon?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffer, far be it for me to ever impugn the motivations of local government. However, since you gave me the opportunity, you could certainly draw that inference from some local fees, yes. And again, as part of the background on this issue, the point of the exercise, as you correctly indicated, is to get money to build the necessary stuff for development to occur. The intent is not to stop development or growth by making it expensive. There are, for jurisdictions that want to stop development and growth, there's probably more linear, straight line ways to do it than just pricing people out, because that, frankly, other parts of the country have adopted that approach, and what you end up with then is usually the same level of growth as richer people doing it, which, depending on your political outlook, I suppose, may not be a bad thing, but it seems fairly bad from a balanced community standpoint.
Thank you.
Other questions? Well, thank you, John.
Thank you very much.
You've brightened our day. I'd like to welcome Richard Reed, Alternatives to Growth, Oregon. I don't know if you have me. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. I realize we've got some time constraints here. I'm Richard.
Well, you have 10 minutes.
Okay. All right. Anyway, I'm Richard Reed. I'm with Alternatives to Growth, Oregon, and I was greatly encouraged to hear the hear Mr. Chandler say that he does approve of systems development charges and likes the way they're working, and he feels the system is working well. Just real briefly here, evidence is mounting that there's a direct link between community growth and the lack of funding for infrastructure, and what the causes are to some degree already attributed. One of the major causes, of course, is that as local communities grow, they have to stretch the current resources to provide services and infrastructure to new construction. So it's like communities start out behind the eight ball and stay behind there, and as we know, the bill was enacted in 1989 to address this problem. It's inadequate as it is, and this is one of the reasons that we have reports like from League of Oregon Cities on diminishing returns, where it's basically saying, it's talking about Oregon's struggle to afford basic services in their summary report in April 2002, and I think some of you might be familiar with that one. Essentially, Measures 5, 47, and 50 make it much more difficult for communities to recoup the costs of growth through taxation. There's plenty of argument and research to show that as growth occurs, it does not provide adequate revenue to begin with, and then with measures 547 and 50, you have even less opportunity for community to recoup the cost of growth. I was also encouraged to hear that these bills are going to get some additional work because they're inadequate as they are. Given the widespread suddenness and depth of the financial crisis in Oregon cities, it's debatable that the increase in assessed values provided reliable funding for future growth. In other words, the argument often is that we grow on our communities, it raises appraised values, and that creates revenue for communities. That hasn't been happening, and I think one of the evidences of that is that the suddenness and widespread depth of financial crisis in Oregon cities. The League of Oregon Cities report says the population growth and demographic trends are placing unprecedented cost pressure on municipal budgets. The way I and many interpret that is saying that as growth occurs, it's not paying its way, and that's going to continue. Just fundamentally, House Bill 2983 would lowball the systems development charge and worsen fiscal problems for communities, so it's good that it's going to be getting some additional work. I would add that one of the reasons I think systems development charges work is that they help raise and sustain property values as communities are able to maintain levels of some services as they grow. So it's a good benefit for the whole growth community. They also help Oregon communities compete for commercial and industrial investment by helping to fund some of the amenities sought by investors, like transportation and parks. SDCs also help the real estate market as communities keep current with the cost of some systems, like water, wastewater, drainage and flood control, transportation and parks. And I would just argue that we avoid lowballing systems development charges and let them work. And I think with that, I'll just close my comments.
Questions? Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, are SDC charges applied to existing home sales? These are only for new construction.
New construction, yes.
So in communities, follow-up, sorry. Madam Chair, follow-up.
Oh, follow-up, please.
So in some of our communities where we've hit that urban growth boundary, aren't cities also being affected by the fact that if you don't have a great deal of new construction, you don't have the ability to charge an SDC to keep up and maintain property values? If that's what I'm hearing from you, that helps us keep property values up, but if you're not able to, if you don't have a large amount of buildable land, there's no SDCs being collected. So,
Madam Chair and Representative Gallegos, if I understand the question, you're saying when a community reaches build out, it might not have the revenue from SDCs?
Yeah.
That would be true, you know, in the sense that SDCs are applied to new construction. There are other matters affecting the real estate market. So when a community reaches build-out, ideally if you have, for example, well-funded systems in that community, property values will be high, taxes, revenues should be healthy, and, you know, there should be some level of stasis there.
Thank you.
Other questions? Chair, I have a comment.
Representative Shoffman.
I think we do have adequate system development charts to provide for infrastructure construction in our communities. Problem, we don't have enough money to maintain our communities and that infrastructure after it's built. And there is a revenue problem, but it's not in system development charges, in my opinion. It's elsewhere, and it's our unwillingness and lack of commitment to provide that revenue to government so we can maintain what we have, in my opinion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Mm-hmm. Well, we will look for these two bills to have work and input and come to a meeting of the minds, hopefully. And thank you for your testimony. I can't believe we got that in that fast. Thank you all for bearing with us. So I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bill 2934, 2983. Is there anything else for the committee? Thank you all. We are adjourned. Okay.